Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Dan Caldwell, who is the Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Pepperdine University. He's the author of the new book, Vortex of Conflict, U.S. Policy Toward Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. Dan, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Oklahoma and lived there until I was 9 years old, and then my family moved to Southern California. And I was raised then in Los Angeles.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
They had enormous influence on me. My mother's parents were missionaries in China for 50 years, so my mother was raised in China. And so I grew up on hearing stories about China and Asia. And then my father joined the Navy in World War II. And was a young naval officer in the Pacific. So both of those influences by my mother and father had a great deal of impact on me.
So was there discussion around the dinner table about international politics and war stories and so on?
It was more personal than sort of policy-based discussions, but we did have a lot of discussions about relatives, friends, and so on that had either lived in China or who had served with my father in both the Second World War and the Korean War.
So was it, what about the influence of, say, high school in terms of going in this direction of becoming an international relations specialist, or did that all then get consummated as an undergraduate?
Well, I was a debater in both high school and college, and typically the national debate topic would focus often on foreign policy issues. So I got interested in policy issues really through debate. And then when I was in college, I joined Naval ROTC, and so I had a direct exposure to international issues, thinking about what the Navy was doing. And of course, when I was in college, it was primarily focused on the Soviet Union and the Soviet Navy.
Mm-hmm. And where did you do your undergraduate work?
I was an undergraduate at Stanford.
And who there were some of your teachers that influenced you? You went on to do your graduate work there, too.
Yes, yeah. I majored in history, and I had an amazing education in history. When I was a freshman, my first year in college, I got to take classes from two visiting British professors, Arnold Toynbee and Michael Howard. And then I had a wonderful undergraduate advisor, Carl Degler. And so I really focused primarily on comparative minority history as an undergraduate studying with Professor Degler.
Mm-hmm. And then on to graduate school, and what did you work on there and under who?
I did a master's degree right out of college at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and then I was on active duty in the Navy for 3 years, and the Navy assigned me to teach, which I'd never really thought about before, so I was teaching officers who were older and senior in rank to me, which was like walking through the classroom door with two strikes swinging. One of the authors I assigned my students to read was Alexander George, and he did political science in a way that was very attractive to me, that was historically based, very rigorous, systematic. And so I went back to Stanford primarily to study with Professor George. And at the end of my graduate education, I had an even higher opinion of him personally and professionally than I did when I started.
Mm-hmm. So how did your training as a naval officer and your service as a naval officer impact your thinking about global affairs, other than making you aware of global affairs?
Yeah, well, it obviously focused my attention on military issues, and since the Navy is a central part of the military instrument of the United States. So it focused my attention on that. Then as the years have gone by, where military has become less important and international relations has gone from being a state-centric system to being a system in which a number of non-state actors are important, my views have changed over the years.
Mm-hmm. And what you said you were teaching in the Navy, what were you actually teaching these officers, and how were they as students?
I was teaching at the Naval Postgraduate School, and I was teaching mid-career officers who had been in the Navy anywhere from 5 to 15 years. And I was teaching in the early 1970s, and I had three principal types of students. I had pilots who had joined the Navy after just 2 years of college. Secondly, I had SEALs, special operations people. And third, I had returned prisoners of war from the Vietnam War. So it was a very, very interesting group to teach and to get to know.
Mm-hmm. You published an article in the Institute of Naval Affairs talking about your father's narration of his service and you and your son and your father visiting a site of a famous battle that he participated in. Talk a little about that. I'm interested about the notion of memory, you know, and how fighting a satisfactory war, the kinds of memories it leaves with soldiers like your father.
Yeah, I think any participation in a war is going to leave deep-seated impressions on people. And my father never talked about World War II or the Korean War in which he had served very much to me, even when I was in Naval ROTC. But my wife and I were out to dinner with my parents on September the 15th. I remember the date for reasons I'll mention. And this was in about 1984, so almost 40 years after the end of World War II. And we were out to dinner, and one of my father's friends said, John, you seem quiet tonight. Why are you quiet? Are you feeling okay? My father, who is normally very talkative, said, no, I'm fine. But he still was quiet, and so his friend asked him a second time, is this an important day to you? Is it when your parents died or something like that? And he said no, and he kind of paused, and he said, this is the day that the Marines invaded Peleliu, September the 15th, 1944, and he broke into tears. And I'd seen him cry once before at the funeral of his father, and so I realized something was going on there. And about 10 years later then, I organized a trip to go back to the South Pacific because my father wanted to go there. So my son and my father and I went back to Peleliu, and I asked my dad why he wanted to go, and he said he always felt like he owed it to the young Marines he saw getting killed on the beaches there. And the other aspect of the trip that was very gratifying is that my dad, for one of the first times, opened up about his experiences and talked openly about them. So it was really a wonderful trip, both for me and my son.
I'm curious, because that particular conflict, on the one hand, it was the what Brokaw has called it, the greatest generation fought the, you know, the greatest war, and everybody is you know, in the same place with regard that was the right war to be fought, and so on. And then, but on the other hand, in this article, what emerges is the weight of history on individuals who have participated. You know, the fellow soldiers, many of whom were very young, who died. Do you have any thoughts or reflections watching your father writing the article about this whole problem of the right war, the memory of the cost, and how it might be different if there were questions raised about the war, as was the case, you know, in Vietnam and the, and the people you mentioned that you were teaching.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting to think about Studs Terkel's characterization of World War II as, quote unquote, the good war. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure there is any good war. There are, in my view, justifiable wars, but I think wars are going to have negative effects both on the place where the war is fought and the people who live there, as well as the people fighting the war. So I'm not, I don't think that there is a costless war. And I would agree with Tom Brokaw's characterization of the Greatest Generation, because my father was captain of a ship when he was 23 years old. And you think about myself when I was 23, I'm not sure I would have been up to that, but millions of Americans were put in a position where they needed to sort of step up, and they did. But I think the other side of that is that as my father's breaking down 40 years after the fact showed that war has an effect and it has a cost, even on those who survive it.
Mm-hmm. Back to your graduate education now. What did you do your dissertation on?
I chose a country that I thought would last my entire career, which was the Soviet Union. And as a backup, I chose an issue area that I thought would last my entire career, which was strategic nuclear arms control. And I did my dissertation on the Nixon-Kissinger policies toward the Soviet Union, particularly focusing on arms control issues.
Mm-hmm. What is that like for somebody who does IR to watch the object of your study sort of disappear from the face of the earth?
Well, there's still a Russia. And the United States and Russia did sign a New START treaty. It was ratified last year. But those subjects are not nearly as important as they were during the Cold War. So it's on the one hand, it's disconcerting to see the focus of your study become less important. On the other hand, it provides the opportunity to expand horizons and change the focus of one study.
Mm-hmm. And looking back, looking back, but also looking forward, let's talk a little about doing the work you do. What were the prerequisites for learning that topic? Where I'm going is I'm interested in sort of what you see as the skill required for somebody who does this kind of work and kind of the quality of character. Because as the Soviet Union disappears, it obviously is a place to become creative and use the skills you have to move on to other subjects.
Well, I think one prerequisite for doing what I do is intellectual curiosity and asking questions about interesting things that we observe. Secondly, is a persistence, because I, like you, were probably in graduate school with a number of brilliant people. I wasn't so brilliant, but I had a lot of persistence, and so I was willing to kind of push through on the subjects that I wanted to focus on. Third is just the methodological approach that one adopts. I was a history major, so I felt that understanding the past was a prerequisite for understanding the present, much less predicting the future. So I think I'm a historically grounded political scientist, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to study with Alexander George, is that he adopted that approach as well.
Did you take any lessons from the study of U.S. policy toward the Soviet Union? I mean, are there things that stick in your mind as kind of lessons learned from that experience?
One of the questions that I sort of came up with in my dissertation, later my first book, was how American presidential administration can sort of frame an American foreign policy and make it reflect or address reality, but not oversimplifying it. So during the Cold War, containment was that approach, but that was, as George Kennan often complained, was really oversimplified, so that the sort of containment approach became communists are bad, anti-communists are good. And obviously, we had some problems implementing that, because the United States wound up supporting some dictatorial regimes, the Shah in Iran or the Marcos regime in the Philippines. And yet then we didn't support others such as Tito in Yugoslavia who were straying from the kind of monolithic communist approach. So that was one of the main lessons that I drew. And then I think one of the other lessons I drew was just unintended consequences of foreign policy. And I think I've seen that in almost anything that I've studied, that American administrations can come up with policies and they want to achieve certain objectives, but reality often bashes those best laid plans, and there are unintended consequences. And I think we saw that in Soviet-American relations, and I think we've seen it in U.S. policy toward Afghanistan and Iraq.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about your new book in a minute. I'm curious with your training in history, your international relations theory, but then looking at a policy issue, were you left with any sense, or what is your take on the interface between theory and policy? I mean, it's in policy, theory is where the tire hits the road, basically. Yeah. And in the case of the Soviet Union, not many people, if any, were predicting what happened would happen.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting question. I remember when I was doing my dissertation interviews, I was interviewing a number of policymakers in Washington, D.C., and I found out that one of them had done graduate work in political science. And so as an earnest young graduate student, I asked him what the last article he read in the American Political Science Review was. And he laughed and said, I haven't read that since graduate school. Mm-hmm. So policymakers are not particularly interested in theory as political scientists develop it, even to the extent that they are turned off by the word theory. So my mentor, Alexander George, when he would talk to policymakers, he would talk to them about what he called generic knowledge as a synonym for theory. And policymakers would immediately warm up to that. They'd say, well, yes, of course, I've learned certain things from being a policymaker. Mm-hmm. And this is the generic knowledge that I have come up with. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's important. And I think the whole development within political science of policy-relevant theory is something that a number of political scientists have worked on the last several decades. And I think it's very important. Just as formal theory is also important, but it's less applicable to actual policy analysis.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your mother came from a missionary background, and I'm curious about how or in what ways you think about ethical issues when you do your work, whether there was any impact there. During the period that you were working on the Soviet Union, ethical issues were really to the fore because of a concern about the dangers of the arms race and so on. The Catholic Church got involved, the bishop's letter and so on. Did you come away from the interface between your background and in these world events with any reflections on, you know, the relevance of ethics for international relations?
Yeah. Well, I think back to one of your initial questions about the influence of my parents on me. They were both devout Christians and raised me in that tradition. And so that's how I think about international relations issues. And I've always been struck in thinking about political science, about a quotation that Aristotle had, which was, and pardon the sexist language, he was speaking in a different time, different context, but he wrote, "The good of man must be the end of politics." And I think that's the case, that politics can be used for the good or the ill of people. And in my study of politics, what I write about, I try to focus on making the world a better place.
Let's talk now about your new book. And the end of the Cold War is actually, in a way, a lead-in to the book, for the reason that once the Soviet Union disappeared in an adversary, there was a decade-long struggle to actually come up with a new strategy, a new way relating to the world. And in the first year of the Bush administration, there appeared to be a focus on the rising power of China,
right,
but that quickly changed to the war on terror,
right,
in the wake of 9/11. So I guess the first question here is, what can we say about the situation America found itself in when that attack came? We really didn't have a strategy for the world at that point, or did we?
No, I don't think we did. I mean, containment policy came to an end on December the 24th, 1991, when the Soviet Union disintegrated. And then there was almost a cottage industry within American political science to come up with a new replacement for containment. So there was Samuel Huntington's concept of the clash of civilizations. There was Frank Fukuyama's end of history hypothesis. A number of political scientists were kind of entering the fray to come up with a new way of thinking about foreign policy. What was happening, though, was, I think, off the radar screen of a number of political scientists. So if we think about 1989, when Gorbachev ordered the withdrawal of Soviet forces from Afghanistan, the United States dropped its support almost immediately following the Soviet withdrawal of the Mujahideen, the opponents of the Soviets in Afghanistan. And Afghanistan then descended into the situation when it was controlled by the Taliban. And I think that Taliban takeover was due, at least in part, to the United States turning its back on Afghanistan and the need to develop one of the poorest countries in the world that had been devastated by 10 years of war with the Soviet Union.
Which raises an interesting question, because the foreign policy that you studied vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and what the policies you're now looking at and looking at the wars on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq raise questions about what our political culture brings to the table, you know, in its foreign policy. And so what the rational notions of how we proceed often seem to get intertwined with what the politics dictates, both in the bureaucracy and in public opinion. Talk a little about that, because when we look at the Bush-Cheney response to the attacks in 9/11, there seems to be an awful lot of that, which in retrospect really detracted from the rationality of the policies.
Well, I think the principal objective of any government is to provide security of its citizens. And so the security of the United States was clearly threatened on September the 11th, 2001. And the Bush administration responded, in my view, in an appropriate way by, first of all, considering carefully where the attack came from. Conclusion was it came from Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda had training camps in Afghanistan and was given sanctuary by the Taliban government in Afghanistan. So the U.S. Then responded about a month after the 9/11 attacks on the United States by attacking Afghanistan, destroying those Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and overthrowing the Taliban government. So I think that was a legitimate response on the part of the United States. I think what was less legitimate was then extending the war to Iraq. And I think in retrospect, when we think about the position of the United States soon after the 9/11 attacks, where we had almost universal support for the United States throughout the world, with Le Monde headline, We Are All Americans, with a number of other very tangible expressions of support for the United States, NATO declaring or invoking Article 5 to come to the aid of the United States. So that we were protected for about an eight-month period by Europeans flying airborne warning aircraft. It was really, in my view of history, the first time Americans were protected by Europeans since the Revolution and the days of Lafayette. But following the American invasion of Iraq, the support for the United States overseas, as well as support for American policy domestically, decreased dramatically. And I think led from an all-time support for the United States, rivaling the support for the U.S. after World War II, to an all-time low support for the United States in the years after U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Your book is very comprehensive, very encyclopedic. There's a limit to, you know, all the issues that you cover that we can discuss here. But I want to focus on one thing because it relates to your prior experience as a Soviet specialist, and that is in the search for a strategy after the fall of the Soviet Union during the first Bush administration of the first President Bush, there was a Pentagon guidance document that projected a notion of the U.S. in its final version essentially preventing the rise of any regional hegemon and seeing that as a threat to the United States. And we have to remind our audience that when the Soviet Union fell, we were number one. No one could balance our power or both our political and soft power, but also our military power. So there was a grappling for a notion. What I'm kind of wondering about when I read your book, one is left with the notion that there was a lot in the Bush administration's responses after the initial response that you just described so well. They were like in the wrong world in a way, that some of what they were seeing in the world related to the conflict with the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union was no longer there, and that it was actually an effort to implement aspects of this Pentagon guidance document.
Yeah, I think it's the 1992 policy guidance that you're referring to, and I think it's interesting to look at the policies of George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president, and then his son, George W. Bush. George Herbert Walker Bush believed in an idea of trying to prevent regional hegemons from emerging, which is precisely the reason that George Herbert Walker Bush actually refused to go to Baghdad, refused to overthrow Saddam Hussein, a policy that was publicly and strongly supported by then Vice President Cheney. But in the ensuing years, the new Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, chose to adopt a policy that tried to take advantage of American supremacy. It was largely a unilateralist policy, where it was the United States going it alone. In the case of Iraq, it was the U.S. plus the British who supported the United States. But it was a predominantly a unilateralist policy. It was a policy that tried to take advantage of American superiority. And I think what we've learned partially from the Iraq wars, both of them, is the value of allies. For example, in the first Gulf War, the war cost a total of $55 billion, and American allies reimbursed the United States $50 billion of that $55 billion. The second Gulf War that we're still engaged in cost the United States about $10 to $12 billion per month. So what that means is that the first Gulf War, 1991, cost the United States the equivalent of about 2 weeks of fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq today. And I think it demonstrates the great, great value of allies in terms of supporting American objectives.
Mm-hmm. And one of the, in your lessons learned section, you talk about knowing the place where you're going, really knowing its geography, its history, and its culture. And by extension, one could argue know the region itself and who the actors are and so on. And if you compare your accounts of the Afghan-Pakistan war on the one hand and Iraq on the other, what you see quite clearly is that we had none of the above in terms of understanding both the internal dynamics and the regional dynamics. Talk a little about that, because it really kind of stands out, and we see that we totally now misunderstood the Shia-Sunni division in Iraq and what the implications of a Shia victory would be for the rise of Iran in that region. And in the Pakistan-Afghan we're suddenly realizing now, well, maybe we have to go to war with Pakistan, or at least put them in their place in order to solve what we see as the problems in Afghanistan.
I think the at least part of my response to your question goes back to the international response to the United States after the attacks on the United States, because we had very strong, tangible support from a number of countries, including the Soviet Union. The first call to George W. Bush after the attacks was an expression of condolence from Vladimir Putin. And Putin offered the assistance of the Soviet of Russia to the United States. And Russia knew more about Afghanistan as a result of its 10-year war there than any other country. And so the Russians actually provided intelligence to the United States. Not only that, but Syria provided intelligence to the United States about its effort to confront terrorists. Syria was one of the countries on the official terrorist list, state supporters of terrorists, that the United States government maintained. And yet here's Syria providing the United States with some information about terrorists. So I think that that's very important in terms of just demonstrating the importance and, again, the way things have changed, because the United States would not get much support from many Islamic countries today. And I think the tensions between the United States and Pakistan illustrate quite clearly what you're talking about in terms of just how the two countries seem to be going in opposite directions now.
How do you account for this unilateralism evidenced by the Bush-Cheney policies on the one hand. And, you know, it's part of a whole configuration, namely the notion of a unitary president, basically, not consulting with the Congress and so on with regard to the conflict. So I guess what I'm sort of I'm curious as to what it was about this particular leadership that was in place, Rumsfeld, Cheney especially, that led them to go down this direction, which was not inevitable, unilateral versus multilateral, limited consultation with the Congress over time, although there was a resolution in response to the attack on the United States.
Well, I think one of the best books on the Bush administration was written by Ivo Dalder and Jim Lindsay, America Unbound. And in that book, in their analysis of the Bush administration, they say that there were essentially three different groups. There were the internationalists, led by Colin Powell, and that was a minority view within the Bush 43 administration. It was probably at least on par with any other group in the Bush 41 administration. Secondly, were the assertive nationalists, so people like Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. And then third were the neoconservatives. And in George W. Bush's administration, the assertive nationalists and the neoconservatives are the ones who are calling the shots. And Colin Powell consistently lost out in his debates with Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Vice President Cheney, and then the second echelon members of the administration. So I think that had a lot to do with it, is just the people whom President George W. Bush put into positions of influence and authority.
And this group, especially the neocons, really sort of saw themselves as realizing this, what was a tendency in American political culture with regard to the world, namely the notion that not only are we the city on the hill who others should emulate, which is one tradition, but another tradition is we should go out and change the world to make it like us, and hence the ideas about democratization and bringing democracy and elections to places like Iraq.
Well, I think that's a very strong tradition in American foreign policy, is the promotion of self-determination and democracy. And I think in that sense, ironically, the neoconservatives were very much in the tradition of Woodrow Wilson. Both wanted to support and promote democracy throughout the world. And I think most Americans would agree with that. But the question is, at what cost? And what are the chances of success of doing that? In Iraq, the neoconservatives were talking about how Iraq would become an example for the rest of the Middle East, and that democratic governments would sweep across the Middle East like a prairie fire. Obviously, that did not happen. There's no more discussion about democracy taking flower in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that those countries becoming examples for other countries in the Middle East as well as the rest of the world.
And ironically, democracy seems to be emerging in the Middle East, but totally unrelated to our intervention in Iraq.
Yeah, I think the whole Arab Spring is interesting to consider. Some neoconservatives argue that it was American intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan that created the prerequisites for the Arab Spring. I don't accept that. In fact, I think it's interesting to think about whether the Arab Spring would have occurred earlier had the United States not intervened in Iraq. In addition to that, the leadership of the Arab Spring is antithetical to the leadership of al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. It's largely a secular group. It's largely nonviolent. And third, it's a group that does favor democratic means. So I think in that sense, it's a real unintended benefit to the United States, because that's precisely what the United States set out to achieve, and yet we've had a difficult time doing that. And those in the Middle East themselves are the ones who have come up with a secular, a nonviolent, and largely democratic movement.
In your book, you identify the elements of the Bush doctrine. We're now talking about W's administration.
Right.
And let's talk a little about that, because the administration had concepts like preemptive war, like a coalition of the willing, and other notions of the particular threat, a very heavy emphasis on the threat posed by the link between technology and nuclear weapons and terrorist groups. In the end, will any of that hold up in the future with possibly this concern about terrorists getting weapons of mass destruction? But the other doctrine, parts of the doctrine, seem not sustainable in retrospect.
Yeah, I think that historians are going to treat the Bush Doctrine very critically. And it's one of the reasons that motivated me to write this book, is to try to, as fairly and as objectively as I could, to analyze some of the elements of the Bush Doctrine. You mentioned that the Bush Doctrine included a reference to the need to preempt threats against the United States. There's a part of international law that justifies preemptive attacks. What the Bush administration did was really create a preventive war, and there is not substantial, if any, support for that in international law. So I think that future historians are going to look back on the Bush Doctrine, its largely unilateral approach for dealing with problems in very critical terms. Already, some of the journalists and other authors who focused on the Iraq War in particular have labeled it as one of the most disastrous foreign policy actions in American history. So Tom Ricks, the author of two excellent books on the Iraq War, Fiasco and The Gamble, has labeled the Iraq War as being one of the greatest disasters in American foreign policy history.
Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly enough, the Bush Doctrine and the Bush actions in the wake of 9/11 essentially really make no sense in a world that's becoming increasingly multipolar, in which emerging economies are feeling their oats now. So, for example, in the case of a preventive war, well, the United States is the leader, is defining a way of war and a doctrine to go with the war, which other countries could potentially imitate, and that's not a world that we would want.
No, I think that's exactly the point, that if the United States can attack other countries in preventive wars, why shouldn't other countries do the same thing? Why shouldn't, for example, Israel attack Iran because of its nuclear program? Well, it's more difficult for the United States to make the case that other countries should not engage in preventive wars, since the United States did that in regard to Iraq. And I would add that, in my view, as I mentioned earlier, that I think that American actions against Afghanistan were legitimate under the doctrine of preemption, but the attack on Iraq was a preventive war that was not legitimate.
Drawing on your military background, I want to get your thoughts on where American military doctrines are going. The Iraq War was partially the implementation of Rumsfeld's notions about how wars are to be fought, a repudiation of Colin Powell and Cap Weinberger's notions about how wars are to be fought, and then coming up with a solution defined by Petraeus. Looking forward, what's going to survive, and what is what are your predictions about how this is all going to come together as we look at future U.S. interventions?
Well, I think one point that I've been struck with as I've researched and written about these wars is the disproportionate price that members of the military and their families have paid for these two wars. Less than 1% of the American population is currently in the military. And to quote Winston Churchill's comment about the Battle of Britain and the pilots who flew in that, thinking about today's military and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I would, sort of changing Churchill a bit, say that never have so many done so little in wars. Because after the United States was attacked on September 11th, after we went to war in Afghanistan and Iraq, civilians have not really been affected by these wars unless they have a loved one in the military or have served in the military. And so I think that that's the first point to be made, is that the military has paid very disproportionately for these wars. I think one result of the wars, ironically, is similar to Vietnam, that the military has been stretched to the breaking point, to quote Colin Powell, by these wars with repeated deployments. I've talked with a number of members of the military, from entry-level enlisted people all the way up to four-star generals. And I think it's a concern at all levels of the military about these repeated deployments, the effect that they're having on those who deploy, as well as the families left home. And so I think that's going to be a long-term concern for American society, is how to take care of those who have served. I think it's also going to really lead to serious questions about further extensive interventions on the part of the United States. Because Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, has estimated that these wars are going to ultimately cost $3 trillion. Well, in an era of economic challenges, the United States, despite the fact that it's still the wealthiest country in the world, can't afford that kind of expenditure in the future. So I think these wars are going to have a definite impact and a long-term impact both on domestic American society as well as on the United States actions in the rest of the world.
One of the places we seem to be heading toward now under President Obama is the use of drones, and that is technology becoming a substitute for boots on the ground. A legacy of Bush-Cheney is also the whole notion of private contractors performing military functions. Do you think, after having studied this what Herb York on this program called the Dark Ages of this, 10-year period of policy choices, not mistakes by the military, but by our policymakers, what can we see in the future about where these policies of privatization, of the use of drone technology, how in the end it might change us as a people and what we stand for in our foreign policy?
On the private contractors, you're quite right that the number of private contractors in Iraq at one point actually was about the same number as the number of U.S. troops there. There were, at the high point of American involvement, about 150,000 American military personnel in Iraq. And at one point, there were that many, if not more, private contractors in Iraq. They're paid very well, although they also take substantial risks. And I think given the economic pressures on the United States, there's going to be less reliance just from an economic standpoint on private contractors. On technology, I think this is a fascinating issue, and it's a sub-theme of my book that I focus on technology and its role in the war on terror and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think one of the fascinating things is to think about, again, how our reliance on technology has unintended consequences. For example, with apologies to Al Gore, who did not invent the Internet, it was the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, in the Department of Defense, who invented the ARPANET, which was the forerunner to the Internet, as a means of providing redundant communications among military bases and command and control centers like Washington, D.C., for the military. So the technology that was invented to increase the security of the United States has come around to, in fact, threaten the security of the United States, because we know that Al-Qaeda used the Internet to recruit, to distribute information, to gain intelligence. So this technology threatens the United States, and the government is currently concerned about the uses of cyber warfare really inflict damage on the United States. The drones and the use of drones, and you're quite right that the Obama administration has increased its reliance on the use of drones in Pakistan and also in other places such as Yemen. I think we'll see continued reliance on that form of technology because it's not as demanding in terms of either American military personnel or contractors, and then it can inflict damage in areas that are very difficult to get to and remote. For instance, in the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan, or in the hinterlands of Yemen and other countries.
It's amazing how many of these issues, what has happened in the last 10 years, have really raised important ethical issues for us as a country and what do we want, what kind of people we want to be and how we want to be perceived. And one of the places is an American tragedy in a way is the failure of intelligence to inform us as to about the kind of conflict we were fighting, say, in Iraq, led to policies of torture at Abu Ghraib. And then previously, the failure of intelligence, or at least the failure of policymakers to listen to intelligence as it was passed to them from the Clinton administration to the new Bush administration, sort of led to policies that really went against the military's tradition in a long-term commitment to the U.S. military not being a party to torture. Talk a little about that, because we wound up in some very dark places with regard to policy because of the blinders that were on the policymakers as they went down this road you've just described.
Yeah. One of my initial reactions to the attacks on the United States on September 11th as I thought about those attacks and the implications, is what are these attacks going to do to the United States? and to the way in which Americans think about international issues, and particularly the ethical aspects of them. And I was very disturbed as a veteran and as a citizen to see the United States adopt what I viewed as torture. I was taught when I was in the military that torture was prohibited under any circumstances. And that was taught to anybody entering the military when I was in it in the 1970s. And then we see the horrific photographs coming from Abu Ghraib showing humiliation, degradation, and torture. I was appalled by that. And I think it's curious to see that many of the leading critics of American policy for what the Bush administration called enhanced interrogation methods were, in fact, members of the military, and particularly the military lawyers, who in many cases were the most critical about adopting those. And I think a number of other members of the military hold to the old standard that torture is wrong. And in interviewing some intelligence officials, both in the United States as well as other countries, they believe that torture is counterproductive, that if someone is being tortured, he or she is going to say anything to get the torturers to stop inflicting pain. And it's far more effective, not to mention ethical, to try to create some identification between the interrogator and the person who's been detained, and to try to create some bonds there to get reliable information as opposed to information that is given under duress and torture.
One final question. At the end of the book, you offer up a list of lessons learned. We don't have time to go through all of them, but I'm just sort of curious. Do you think that the country, the Obama administration, has learned the lessons of this last decade, or is that something that will become more apparent in the future? President Obama has said, let's look forward, not backward. Is that a mistake?
Well, I think clearly the Obama administration has tried to learn from both of these wars. And I think it's striking that when President Obama came into office, his inclination, and indeed some of what he mentioned during the 2008 campaign, was to withdraw from Afghanistan. And after his intensive investigation and consideration of U.S. policy in Afghanistan, he concluded that the United States needed to send another 30,000 troops to Afghanistan. So I think he is trying to look at the data, and even when it goes against his initial inclinations, he's willing to make the decision to do what he thinks will be most effective on the part of the United States.
Well, on that note, Dan, let me show your book one more time to our audience. It's really a tour de force and very comprehensive in terms of all of the issues related to both sets of wars. So thank you for coming on our program and visiting the Berkeley campus.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.